Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Nerd Bomber from Online Warriors, and we are going to be talking about Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie, which won the 2014 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So Nerd Bomber, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm super glad to be on the show today.
Yes, I'm excited to have you. I think we found each other on Twitter at some point.
I believe so, yeah, because I was actually just looking for new podcasts to listen to because, as you mentioned, I'm a podcaster myself, and I always like to listen to a lot of different indie podcasts, and I'm a big avid reader, so I stumbled upon you on Twitter and started listening to the show and really, really enjoyed what I heard. Super neat concept, reading through all of the Hugos. I really like it.
Yeah, I like it too, and I like that I get to talk to different people all the time. So let's talk about you, kind of some of your origin, your nerdy history, and why don't you actually start by talking about Online Warriors?
Okay, yeah. So I'm one of three co-hosts on the Online Warriors podcast. And so for the last 3 years, we created a show where we're basically talking about all of the different headlines in nerd culture news every week, anything from gaming to movies to even like cool spacey tech stuff. And it kind of started as a way for me and my friends to just keep in touch because we had ran a website together and that kind of dissolved. And before we parted ways, we just wanted a way to keep talking to each other every week about the stuff that we really loved. So it's kind of grown into this now weekly show with a great little community around it. And we really love what we do.
Cool. Well, I can definitely recommend people check it out because it's very enjoyable. I love the chemistry between everyone. Obviously, there's chemistry between you and Tectic. I think you guys are engaged,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we are engaged. We're actually planning to get married later this year, but things had to change a little bit because obviously the COVID situation. But still, it's been a really fun time because we're both working from home. So I feel like some people that might great on them to be around their significant other all the time, but we've had a really good time being home a lot.
I also really enjoy that you guys always end the show with kind of a quiz show.
Yeah, it's kind of a thing that we started doing because we all like looking up random facts and learning about things. So it was just something that we started doing at the end of every show, trying to dig a little bit deeper into topics and get some little trivia tidbits.
Nice. All right, what about you? What's your nerdy history?
So anyone who knows me knows that I'm basically just a gigantic overall nerd. I love video games. I love like science fiction and fantasy shows and movies. And I mean, come on, I run a nerdy podcast. So like super in the weed nerd. But I think it all started when I was a kid. And a lot of it started with reading. My mom was super big on getting like all me and my brother and sister reading at a really young age. And I really gravitated towards like the fantasy and science fiction side of things early on. Mm-hmm. I remember reading like The Giver and running through all of the Redwall books, which is still such an amazing series. Mm. And eventually I stumbled upon Ender's Game and really found that like space opera and science fiction genre and really kind of fell in love with it. So then I started hunting down more and never really looked back.
Awesome. I've noticed that you guys keep it pretty PG, PG-13.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we try to make our content a little bit accessible to everybody because we know, I mean, everybody from all ages love the kind of nerdy stuff that we talk about. I mean, gaming and books and movies, there's really no single age group that really gravitates towards these things. So we never know what our audience is going to be like. And we kind of like to keep things a little bit open for everybody. And especially too, if people want to listen and have their kids in the car or something on their commute,
right?
Like we want to make sure that it's accessible to everybody.
Well, I appreciate that. So, and I'm sure there's plenty of other people out there who do. So we've talked about your history as a science fiction fan. Did you tally up your Hugo winners reading total?
I did, yeah. And if I'm being honest, I'm a little embarrassed because it's not as many as I thought and not as many as I liked. So when I ran through the list a few months ago, I think I've only actually read about 10 of them. And the thing is, though, I was going through the list and I've only read 10 winners, but I've read a lot of the nominees. So I'm not sure if those count to pad my stats. But honestly,
it's at least something you can feel good about.
Yeah. But there's so many science fiction novels coming out all the time. And honestly, so many that don't even make the Hugo list. And it's so hard to keep up with them all.
It sure is. Yeah. And, you know, for me, like I listen to some other book-based podcasts and they're listening or they're reading, you know, newer stuff. And I'm like, I'm never going to get to read that because I've set myself this project to read all the winners. And so I don't get to do as much extracurricular reading as I'd like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the list of Hugos, I guess I didn't realize when the Hugo Awards started, but it was like the early 50s. So there's quite a few books on that list.
Yes, there are. So, okay, so let's talk about this book and why you wanted to read it, or why you chose it. I think this was a first time read for you, right?
Yes, this was. Okay. So when the book came out, I think this was back in 2013 because it won the 2014 Hugo. I had heard so many rave reviews about this, and I heard that it was a super unique and interesting read. But mm-hmm. I'm one of those people, because I heard it was the start of a trilogy, that I like to wait till all the books come out so I can kind of binge through them.
Right.
And by the time the trilogy had actually finished, a couple years after Ancillary Justice came out, I'd kind of forgotten all about it, sadly. Mm-hmm. so this is a great way to get back into it and finally start the trilogy, because I do plan now, after we record this episode, I'm going to dive into the next two books and finish it up.
Nice. I'm pretty good at reading the first book in a series. And then I don't usually even set out to read entire series unless it's something that I really, really enjoy. So, you know.
Well, it's hard too when a series come out, like you wait a year and you don't really remember what happened in the last book. So exactly. I totally understand that.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I like about audiobooks, is that I feel like if I've read something in print, then when the next one comes out, I can like check out the audiobook and catch up.
Mm-hmm. So that's actually really smart. I might steal that idea.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good way to refresh on, well, what happened in that book? I mean, it's like, it's more involved than like just going to the Wikipedia page and reading, you know, somebody's plot summary of it.
Yeah. But honestly, sometimes you go and do that and the person who writes the plot summary, obviously they can't capture everything that happens. So there's so many little details that you'll miss.
Mm-hmm. Well, that being said, why don't we dive into our kind of non-spoiler discussion of the book? So can you give, I'm curious how this will go, like a non-spoiler synopsis of the book or elevator pitch for the book?
All right. So basically, the way that I would describe this book is the main character, Breck, is an AI and one of many AIs dedicated to a ship, the Justice of Torin. And essentially what happens is she splits off from her main ship and the rest of her AI body, which I don't want to give a spoiler, so I'm not going to say why or how or what happens. Mm-hmm. And basically this single portion of her AI being has a mission that she wants to carry out. And so the story basically follows what happened to get her to that point and then how and why she's carrying out her mission.
Right.
I think that's probably a somewhat decent elevator pitch.
That is. Yeah, that's really good. How about overall thoughts? What'd you think of this one?
I thought this was probably one of the most original and complex science fiction adventures I've gone on in a really long time. It's got a bunch of compelling characters. They all have their own little personal vendettas and motivations. There's a lot of like good old sci-fi space opera action and a whole super interesting intergalactic society to learn about. And Anne Leckie doesn't really go into super detail with some of the world building and kind of leaves you to figure out pieces as the story goes. But it's just super interesting to learn about this entire basically empire that's being built in the story.
Yeah, I think complex is a really, really good word for it. I was thinking it's not complicated, but it is complex because there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of backstory that you get through the book that leads to kind of the conclusion of this one and leading into the rest of the next series. And there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of, why is this person doing this? Why is that person doing that? You know, and there's some kind of coincidental stuff that comes into it that I think some people might be turned off by, but I really enjoyed this one as well. It's a good read. It's, like you said, very unique in the way it's written, and I don't want to give away all of that right away. Maybe we can save that for spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I think most people know going into it that there's a particular technique used in this one. So I'm not sure whether to give it away or not. What do you think?
I think it's something that you don't expect necessarily. If you haven't read anything about this book, if you don't know anything about it going in, it's something very interesting to try to grapple with. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if we want to necessarily reveal it, but I will say that it is something that is kind of confusing, but also interesting to grapple with throughout the entire reading experience of this book.
Yeah, definitely. Well, why don't we move on from that instead of going into spoilers on that? We'll save that for later. Can you think of any comps for this book? You know, who might like this if they've read something else or seen something else?
I would say if you like any kind of space opera in any format, you'll probably find something to like in this book. Mm-hmm. So like if you're a big Corey or Scalzi fan, you probably would be drawn to this book and find it pretty enjoyable. I could also see if you want to get out of books, like fans who are really into sweeping sci-fi RPGs, something like Mass Effect would really enjoy this book as well. I don't know if you've played that game at all, that game series, but that's probably one of my all-time favorites.
I've heard a lot of good stuff about it. I just haven't really been a gamer in the console gaming era. Mm-hmm. You know, give you an idea of my age. One of my friends down the street had a Atari 2600.
My dad exposed me to that growing up. So I had a lot of fun on that console too, actually. That was one of the first things that I played.
Yep. I remember when one of my really good friends at the end of my street for Christmas got the original Nintendo, the NES, I guess we call it now. We just called it Nintendo back then. Mm-hmm. And that was middle school, I think. And we spent all of Christmas break playing the original Legend of Zelda and Super Mario Brothers.
I will say it is kind of crazy to think about how quickly gaming has evolved, because just looking back at those original games and then talking about something like Mass Effect, that basically is a gamified space opera with those complex and layered characters and a sweeping storyline. I think it's just incredible to kind of look at how things have evolved.
It is. It really is. And, you know, I was talking to my son about this, who just graduated high school, and he's like, I don't think people actually, you know, my generation, that's where reading is going to end. You know, we're going to be like, you know, we like movies, but even movies are great and everything. But like video games are where the storytelling is really happening right now.
I feel like most people, a lot of people, at least in the younger generation, because my nieces and nephews, they're around like 10, and they're starting to figure out their place in terms of reading and gaming. And mm-hmm. I think my nephew kind of hit the nail on the head where he's kind of found that they complement each other, because if you really like the story-based telling in video games, then he made the jump to like the video game-based novels. And then some of those authors, they're actually pretty popular science fiction writers that mm-hmm. these gaming companies have enlisted to write story lore for their games. So a lot of it has some overlap, and then hopefully kids these days don't give up on reading entirely,
right, because hopefully not.
There's good stories to find.
Yeah. Well, even too, when you look at the production level on video games, you know, you get top tier voice talent, you know, Hollywood actors and, you know, motion capture performances and stuff in those.
Oh, yeah, for sure. There is a game that I just played, Detroit Become Human, that is kind of relevant because it also addressed and tackled AI. And the motion capture and the voice acting in that game was incredible. There were cutscenes and honestly felt like I was watching a movie.
Nice. So I wrote down a couple things for comps. One of them is kind of spoiler, so I'm going to save it for later. But yeah, like you said, right? Anybody who's interested in space opera or enjoys that kind of thing, or even really military science fiction, there's some elements of that here. So like your Old Man's War series kind of stuff from Scalzi. I think The Expanse is a fairly good comp.
Oh, yeah, that is.
Yeah, just in a couple ways where like there's definitely military aspects to that, but it's not all about that. Mm-hmm. I'm told it's a lot like Ian Banks's Culture series, which I haven't read any of. So that's one of those science fiction blind spots that I have that I need to fill in.
Yeah, I had actually heard that there were a lot of similarities, and I haven't read it either. But after I finish up this series, I think I might actually dig into that, because now it's kind of piqued my interest now that I've seen so many comparisons between the two.
I think it's probably a good time for us to just get into spoilers. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so too.
Okay. So right at the top, kind of, you know, in the spoiler section, there's no particular format, anything that stuck out from the book that you want to talk about, any plot points, any themes, feel free to throw them out and we'll talk through them.
All right. I guess first, so the one thing that I would like to say is that if I'm being totally honest, the first third of the book was kind of a little confusing, and not in like a bad way, but and like he definitely just throws you in and you don't really understand what Breck's purpose is. You get a lot of the detail in the culture, and like I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, their Raj culture.
Yeah.
And a lot of it, there's not so many info dumps, but you're just trying to piece together what this culture is and how the annexations are impacting the different areas that they're taking over. And I would say that, especially with the time period jumps between chapters and locations, I think if you can get through probably the first third of the book and power through that, the plot really starts to crystallize then.
Yeah.
And I would say once Anander, oh man, the pronunciations, when there's so many vowels in the names, I really struggle with that. But when basically the Imperial leader of the Ratch shows up on the Justice of Torin, I think that's when the story really takes off.
Yeah, big time. And that's an amazing moment, actually, when all that occurs. So I read this one and I listened to the audiobook. And so the audiobook narrator says, Ana Ander Miana Ai.
Okay.
So I guess I'm given to understand that Anliki says, pretty much if it's grouped vowels, you just pronounce every one of the vowels.
Gotcha. So, okay.
But that's a pretty complicated name.
I've noticed that's a trend in science fiction lately, though. Lots of vowels.
Yeah. Yeah. Like you said, I mean, it does. I wouldn't say it started slowly. It's just sort of, it drops you into it and it doesn't give you a whole lot of context. And so it was a little jarring for me at first when you had the two storylines going, where you have Breck on this planet. Well, I can't remember what the planet was. Nilt, I think. Mm-hmm. And she finds Syverdin, and is nursing that character back to health. And then you have the other timeline that is earlier, that's on that other planet, Shishurna, I think. Mm-hmm. And there's some notion that it's, you know, hundreds of years ago, or at least decades ago. And it makes you wonder, wait, okay, who is Breck? How old is Breck? And there's the confusion of the fact that everybody is referred to with female pronouns.
Oh, yeah. I mean, so the female pronoun thing I thought was very, very interesting. And I don't know, I think I've only seen that kind of done before in one other book, and the book is actually escaping me. But it's probably one of the most interesting and unique things about this book, because as you're reading, it's very difficult to identify whether someone is a man or a woman. And obviously that's trying to get you in the head of Breck, because AI, obviously they're not human. So they have a very difficult time identifying people's genders just based on their physical attributes. So ultimately they just fall back on the Ratch standard of referring to everyone with female pronouns. And at the end of the day, I think that was almost kind of purposeful, because the only thing you could then judge the characters on were really their actions. Mm-hmm. So it was either trying to get you in an AI state of mind, or trying to make a statement how at the end of the day, the gender of the character really doesn't matter. It's really what they do that matters. And that's how you characterize the people around you.
Yeah. I'm kind of two minds about the whole thing, because I feel like it's really interesting science fiction, just the science fiction of linguistics, where how would you come to a point of having a language that was genderless like that, when obviously humans fall into, you know, at least two genders, right? And so having that extra bit of description is helpful. And so it makes me wonder, how would that happen? And there would have to be societal implications. And they are mentioned, right, that everybody kind of dresses the same. And like, long hair isn't particularly female, short hair isn't particularly male. The style of clothing, you know, can be different across the board. And so, I don't know, I thought it was an interesting sort of lateral thinking thing that it forced on you.
Yeah, and I think besides Svarden, who is labeled as a man, I think pretty explicitly in one of the scenes, I honestly, I had trouble trying to figure out who was who. Like, I don't think I could tell you any other character what gender they were. And you're right. No. Like, that does make it very interesting, because you do have to think about the cultural ramifications of that. Like, how would that culture reproduce if they only really recognize linguistically one gender? Like, how do they propagate, I guess?
Right. It even talks about that, right? I remember somebody asking, how do you reproduce? And they're like, well, you have your contraceptive implant deactivated. So I guess they figure it out. One thing I thought was interesting was, I have always thought that the series was Imperial Reach, because of that phenomenon where if the first letter and the last letter match a known word, your brain kind of slips that word in there. Have you ever seen that, where it's like it's a block of text where all the words are scrambled, but the first and last letters of all the words are correct? And so you can actually read it. Your brain.
You know, I have seen that. I didn't put that together when I was reading this book for whatever reason. I think it's one of those things where when you see a lot of the words mixed up like that, your brain just automatically goes and kind of clicks over into that method of reading where it just does it and makes the leap for you.
The AI is another. So this is one of the things about this book. I feel like you, like we mentioned earlier, right? It's complex. There's a lot of different moving parts. There's a lot that's going on. There's tons of science fiction. And sometimes you have a book, like my last episode was a book that has one idea in it, and that's it. It's very, and it's 50s science fiction. What do you expect? But you have this one and you're like, wow, I'm lucky. You could have done with one or two of these ideas and made an entire book out of it. Instead, you took all five of them. And I don't know, maybe some people would be frustrated with that level of world building going on. And I'm not the kind of person who really enjoys world building. It's one of the reasons I'm not attracted to fantasy most of the time. Mm-hmm. But I feel like she built out a really, really solid universe here that she can play around with for a long time.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think the idea of there being so many different planets under this one realm of conquest really opens up the ability for her to move around. And I guess we'll find out in the next couple books, but basically just opens the door for so many different things to happen and so many different themes to be explored. I mean, even in this first book, in terms of even examining artificial intelligence and what it means to be human, I mean, she explored kind of the themes of nature versus nurture and exactly like what does it mean to be human? Like, does emotion set human apart from anything else? I think that was actually the nature versus nurture thing was one of the things that she tackled a lot, because the split of these AI entities, both with Mian and I and Brad, they lend itself to the conversation where, like, these machines, obviously each segment of the machine has the same identical programming, but they end up having different ideals and different experiences in each of their different segments based on their unique experiences. And like, case in point, Breck is an individual ancillary, ends up developing a slightly different personality and then a completely different loyalty than some of the other units of Justice of Torin. And that ultimately is what sets her on the path that starts the whole trajectory of the story.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. This is something that kind of just occurred to me, because with Breck being part of a larger AI for a ship, you can, I don't know, I can kind of go, okay, all the ancillaries have enough wiring in them, and the computing is complex enough that you can have Breck still think of herself as the ship. But I'm not sure how that applies with the Lord of the Ratch. We can just say that instead of Anand or Mianai. Because I think I understood that Anand is actually human. And so how does the splitting into more than one body work? And I'm not sure. We don't have any kind of answer to that. And it makes me think she's also an AI.
The feeling that I got, and obviously, like you said, we don't really have a true answer to that, but the feeling that I got was that almost as if she was a human at one point, but especially because they allude to her living for so long. And obviously, we don't know the medical technology in this world. It seems very advanced, but I don't know if it could make an entity live for thousands of years. And it almost seems as if it was a human consciousness at one point that was then converted into an AI so that it could oversee the rule of the entire empire.
Yeah. Have you read or watched Altered Carbon?
I have, yeah.
Okay. That's another comp that I had here that was the one that I didn't want to bring up because it's kind of spoilery because of the whole idea of having more than one body and having the personality that controls the body be separate, because you kind of have the Lord of the Ratch is sort of double-sleeved, right? Or not even double-sleeved, many, many copies. And there's always that question that comes up, well, which one is actually you? It's the teleportation problem in a lot of ways. Whereas the person who stepped into the teleporter, the same person who steps out of the teleporter, or is it a copy that thinks that it's still you? And that kind of thing always burns my brain.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing to think about, because I guess a lot of people would probably say that the original copy is probably you. But at the end of the day, eventually, once you make that split, it's almost like completely different people, even though you're the same person. Now, one question I had for you, actually.
Okay.
So there was a point in the book where they're explaining how ancillaries are created. And they make a, and Lecky makes a point to say that the host bodies of, or of ancillaries really only work if they're alive. So they basically right. keep these bodies in suspension and then wake them up when they're ready to turn them into ancillaries. Mm-hmm. So there's that entire interesting characteristic where the Justice of Torin, but also Breck, likes to sing. And if you're thinking about it from like a pure AI computer program perspective, there's really no reason that AI would want to sing if they didn't have emotions. And they right. also, they make a point to say that the ancillaries can't work without emotions. So do you think that that subconscious is still in there and that's what's driving the emotion and personality of Breck and other ancillaries? Or do you think it's all just authentically the AI adapting and becoming smart enough to have its own consciousness?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I feel like the book is leading us towards the individual units of the ancillaries are part of that, right? It's not just the AI. Or mm-hmm. I guess you could say that it's an emergent property of the AI with the ancillaries. And so it's like the AI is learning from every finger that she has. Mm-hmm.
It's just a lot of brain-bending concepts.
it sure is. And you have that, it's a fantastic scene, the slaughter in the temple of Amaat in Ors, where Breck first experiences that disconnectedness, where the communication is all cut off for a brief mm-hmm. amount of time. And that's kind of what fuels her the rest of the time and allows her to figure out, you know, how to be solitary, because she had experienced it that one time.
It'll be interesting as we move forward too into the rest of the series. I don't mm-hmm. know if you're going to plan to read them, but now that we've seen the Lord of the Wretch kind of experience that herself, I wonder how that will propagate and how that will kind of influence the rest of the plot, because obviously we've seen that it can cause a single ancillary unit to basically become a completely different entity. So now that yeah. kind of communications were set down or shut down with the Lord of the Wretch, like now there's so many, because it seems like there's almost an infinite number of individual units.
Yeah. One of the things in this book, you know, going back to that idea of it being complex, is it's like the book is like a butterfly effect. What happens in the plot is because of so many different separate events, because you have the mention of the Garsed massacre, right? And I like this quote. It says, "For the first time, Wretch forces dealt death on an unimaginable scale without renewal afterward, cut off irrevocably any chance of good coming from what they had done." And this is in reference to the Garsedians, or who, I can't remember what they were called, had assassinated some of the Wretch, and mm-hmm. the Lord of the Wretch had decided, we're killing all of them, we're destroying them entirely. And that, you know, it's a horrifying thing, the idea of genocide or xenocide, depending on if they were alien. I think they were human, but you have that as that background that caused some of the original splinter in the Lord of the Wretch. And then you have something happening on one of the stations where an aspect of the Lord of the Wretch was taking that over and trying to build up and make war against the other parts. Mm-hmm. And it just, yeah, like you said, it kind of boggles the mind.
I think it's interesting too, just looking at other of the AI related themes. Like towards the end of the book, we find out that many of Breck's associates, I'll call them, I guess, now kind of think of her as human. And the Lord of the Wretch even goes so far as to grant her citizenship. Granted, that's kind of using her as a tool. Right. And that kind of begs the question too, like, what does define humanity? Because mm-hmm. yes, technically Breck is AI, but as we see throughout the entire book, she clearly has feelings and emotions, no matter how hard she tries to suppress them. Yeah. And clearly feeling that much love for Dawn was enough to set her on this quest to upend an entire civilization to avenge mm-hmm. her or him. And even throughout the novel, her relationship with Savardin, she keeps trying to say that she doesn't know why she keeps him around and uses him as a tool. But it's very yeah. clear that she's developing some sort of kinship toward him. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very interesting to see, because throughout the entire book, like in the very beginning, I think Breck was portrayed to be kind of robotic in terms of how she was reacting to situations and people that she would encounter. But as mm-hmm. the novel went on, it became very clear that she was just as emotional as a regular human, just trying to suppress it. So yeah. as the novel went on, I even started thinking of her as almost like a human character. Like I stopped thinking of her as this cold AI character.
Yeah. I honestly, every time I pictured Breck, I pictured the cover art from the Murderbot books, mm-hmm. All Systems Red. Who is the author of those? Martha Wells.
Yes.
Yeah. And I kind of pictured her as almost that because, of, you know, it does describe that there are implants that the ancillaries have in order to be kind of part of the AI and be enhanced soldiers as well. Mm-hmm. The idea of the kind of increasing humanity of Breck is interesting. And I've heard other podcasts talking about ancillary justice, and they think of the ancillaries as dead. And the book does refer to them, has characters refer to them as corpse soldiers. And in a lot of ways they are, right, because they've lost their autonomy. And that's yes. kind of a fundamentally human thing, right? And it reminds me of one of my favorite books from when I was a kid is The Black Cauldron by Lloyd Alexander. And in that series of books, the big bad there has this magical cauldron where he can reanimate soldiers and bend them to his will. And it silences them and takes away their free will. And so it's a very horrifying thing. And the idea of being captured and turned into an ancillary is something that's chilling.
Oh, for sure. I think this is probably one of the few books that I've seen kind of tackle something that, as you said, chilling, kind of head on.
Yeah.
Because for the most part, like those type of soldiers, the undead soldiers, you always see them as kind of a tool, mm-hmm. but they're never really a main character. You never really see like a reanimated corpse as a main character, even if they have some new AI implant.
Yeah.
And there was that that interaction between Breck and, oh, I can't remember her name now. The healer who she got the gun from. Mm. But they have a conversation where the healer kind of shows disdain for Breck and what she is as an ancillary. Mm-hmm. And Breck basically goes on to say, like, okay, but I have my own life now. So would you have me get rid of my own consciousness to bring back this hidden suppressed consciousness that is in my body? Like how do you tell me that my consciousness is worth less than the original life that was in this body?
Yeah.
Which is a really interesting to think about, especially again, going back to AI and like what makes them human, because essentially if you have thoughts and feelings, how do you compartmentalize that and say, well, that's just a programmed being. Right. They don't really count as much as a regular born human being would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's Strigan or Strigan that you were thinking of.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of reminds me of RoboCop in a way, where you have this person who has a face that's recognizable by some people, but maybe a different entity altogether now. And I don't feel like the book talks too much about, you know, who Breck was originally. It's always Breck in the context of being Justice of Torin. And I'm curious if right. there even is the possibility that we'll get any other backstory on who provided Breck's body. But I kind of doubt it.
I kind of hope so, because I think that would be really interesting. But because the body, I feel like, I don't know if Breck would even know. You know yeah. what I mean? I think to the AI system, it would just be like another vessel, and they probably don't have the information. Because, I mean, I could imagine if I was somebody putting the system together and creating ancillaries, I don't know if I would necessarily want the AI to have that kind of empathy with their right. host, because I feel like that might develop into a whole sort of different problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the AIs definitely know the size and shape and capabilities of their ancillaries, but do they know, you know, who they were before? I don't know.
Because, I mean, it's very clear that the AIs have capability to empathize with people. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in the early scenes on Ors, when the little girl kind of comes to the temple and is very afraid, I mean, Breck has the empathy to kind of sympathize with her and make the girl feel at ease. And if it was just like a non-feeling AI,
yeah,
you wouldn't have that.
Yeah, even when you look at the flashbacks to when Justice of Torin knew Syverdin from before, and mm-hmm. Syverdin was very impulsive and reactionary, and Justice of Torin actually stepped in to distract Syverdin at a point when she was about to do something bad. I can't remember the actual specifics of it, but she was reacting really badly to a situation, and the ancillary was able to kind of tap him on the shoulder and go, there's a message for you, you know, just to be a distraction. Mm-hmm.
I think Syverdin was actually a character that I really enjoyed watching the development arc for. Because in the very beginning of the book, I didn't really understand his point. It really seemed like it was just something for Breck to take care of and just kind of almost like a puppy dog little mission to just make sure that he didn't perish.
Right.
But as the book went on, you could obviously he changed in his attitude, especially as Breck went on to save his life multiple times. He eventually had appreciation and gratitude towards her. Yeah. But also, I thought it became a very important kind of tether for Breck because as the book went on, I couldn't imagine as an AI having thousands of years of experience under your belt,
right,
not being able to relate to most of the modern day people that you would encounter in society.
Yeah.
And he basically acted as somebody who could relate to the world as it was 1,000 years ago and kind of voice some of the changes and the things that he didn't understand about the world today.
Right.
And I think it kind of served as that, like I said, that tether that Breck needed to just kind of have someone that could relate to her and give her something to take care of so she didn't totally go off the rails too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right down to the language vernacular had changed a bit in 1,000 years, which makes sense.
Exactly.
So I talked about the fact that there's some kind of some coincidence in there about the fact that Breck just happens to come across Syverdin, who Justice of Torin knew 1,000 years ago, and you know that has disappeared at least once. I think it had disappeared and then disappeared again. And the more I thought about it, I saw a couple other folks writing about, you know, I just couldn't handle the fact that this person who ended up being kind of crucial to the way the book comes out was just, there was a coincidence at the heart of all that. But I felt like, sure, the initial meeting that they had, it could be termed coincidence, but the fact that they stuck together, I got the impression that Breck slowly kind of realized that Syverdin could be important. And there were a few times where Breck was just throwing up her hands and going, okay, I got to ditch this person. And I like that part of it that led to the fall from the bridge where she's like, I'm done. I'm walking. She sold my ship. So I'm out of here.
I mean, I think I know it's coincidental from the point that it kind of happened early on in the book and it really didn't have a lot of context around it. But at the same time, Leckie kind of leads you to believe that Breck's mission has been ongoing for quite a long time. She's been searching in many different worlds. So I understand why people don't necessarily like the coincidental aspect of that, but I kind of justify that in my head thinking like, oh, you know, she's been going all over the place trying to find this gun and locate Dragon, and she's bound to run into someone she might recognize like at some point in her journeys. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I feel like we kind of came in at the end of her quest because we really, when the book starts off, she's pretty much already found the gun. She knows where she needs to go. Mm-hmm. But we weren't privy to the years before that where she had to hunt and search and kind of track Dragon down. So she could have gone decades without seeing anybody that she recognized. So I think it is coincidental. And when it occurred, it just kind of happened at the right place and time. Mm-hmm. But I think if you look at the overarching quest she probably faced, it was bound to happen at some point that she might run into somebody.
Right, right. What I think is interesting, though, is that it's almost like Syverdin is another disconnected ancillary because he's been plucked out of his context, you know, no longer knows how to move in the world, no longer knows what to do, and has, you know, kind of gone over to abusing some kind of narcotic, what they call it, Kef?
I thought it was very interesting how, because the Kef kind of lent itself to exploring how the search to kind of numb your feelings ultimately kind of leaves you aimless, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it kind of was a good foil to Breck, who kind of shunned that kind of lifestyle as an AI and really leaned into her emotions instead and gave her more purpose. Granted, she experienced tragedy and stuff, but gave her more purpose and a quest to follow.
Yeah. Yeah, Breck is an interesting character because of, like you said, the long experience that she had, plus, you know, the tragedy and the triumphs and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, the personal tragedy of, you know, being responsible for that, the massacre in that temple, you know, obeying the orders from the Lord of the Ratch, because that's what ancillaries do. They obey. And then, you know, in a crucial seen executing her friend, which was kind of shocking.
That I was very taken aback that she went through with it as the Justice of Torin. Like, I kind of assumed that that moment where she would separate and refuse the order would happen prior to shooting on. But when, like, I think I actually put down my Kindle at that point and was like, wow, I was not expecting her to actually follow through, especially because to that point in the story, Lucky had been building up the fact that she was kind of not agreeing with the Lord of the Ratch, that she wasn't necessarily going to respond and follow through with what the Lord of the Ratch wanted, especially after the massacre happened. Yeah. So it was kind of a shocking moment. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a great impetus, though, to understand how Breck got to where she was, how she ended up being alone by herself with this incredibly, it seems like a crazy and foolhardy mission to begin with. Because honestly, to try to take down the Lord of the Ratch, who has, even when she was talking about her idea of killing the Lord of the Ratch, I mean, there's so many different instances. I didn't even really grasp how she would be able to do that. Mm-hmm. But having to kill a commander that she loved basically completely obliterated any logic that she might have had to kind of step back and be like, this doesn't really make sense.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I thought in that scene, it's like Justice of Torin was analyzing, you know, what are the possibilities here? What can I do? If I want to fulfill my mission here, I have to execute her and kind of make it look like I'm still completely on the Lord of the Ratch's side, and then I can maneuver later. But then after she shoots Lieutenant On, then immediately turns her gun on the Lord of the Ratch, which then, you know, spins off into the destruction of the actual ship.
I will say it was very interesting from a writing style. I wasn't sure if Lucky would be very successful in being able to portray just having so many different bodies and units, because the Justice of Torin obviously had many, many bodies that were moving around oars, moving around the ship. And I think that she did a really good job of being able to transition between Breck as a single unit and the Justice of Torin as a whole.
Right.
And I thought it was really interesting, even when she was talking about being able to sing as a chorus as a whole, because she had so many different bodies, and even being able to, in basically the same page, show what each of the different ancillaries were thinking and doing and seeing and observing.
Yes.
I thought she did that very cohesively, and it was very impressive.
Yeah, very skillfully done. Because I like the fact that it didn't, when it would be shifting perspectives between different ancillary segments and the AI, there wasn't like a page break that clued you into that. It would just say, you know, one Ask whispered this to somebody and one Var did something else. And yeah, that was cool. That reminded me a little bit of The Demolished Man, which in that book there are ESP sensitive people who can read minds and project thoughts and stuff. And so some of the interactions between those characters reminded me of the way she handled it in Ancillary Justice, because it essentially, it almost is like ESP, right? Because it's fast communication between different segments of the same personality.
Yeah, I think, honestly, there are probably very few people who could have pulled off what she did in this book and had it be as cohesive and interesting and engaging the entire time. And like, sure, there were confusing parts in the beginning, but I think it all kind of came together and cohesed as the story went on. Mm-hmm. And nothing really felt out of place. Like, especially when you got to the end of the book, you could look back at the beginning of chapters and be like, okay, everything kind of falls into place here. Everything makes sense now. I think the one coincidental thing that I don't necessarily know if I liked was when Auer became the inspector and showed up on the station towards the end of the book. That was probably the one coincidental thing that I thought was a little bit of a reach. But
it made sense. You know, I mean, there's military kind of ranks, promotions, and that sort of thing. And you also get the notion from the Lord of the Ratch that the Lord of the Ratch had kind of been keeping that family around, that house around. And that's another one of the pieces of world building that you have. You know, you have the Imperium itself, and then you have all these different houses and clientage and all that kind of stuff that, I don't know, as an American, I don't like it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I kind of hope to learn more about those systems mm-hmm. as we get into the next books, because they were explained on the surface, but I still don't know if I totally understand what clientage entailed,
yeah.
I guess. So it would be interesting to see a little bit more of that and a little more in-depth explanation.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the key differences between the different Lords of the Ratch who are deciding what direction to take the Empire, where one of them is saying, you know what, anyone should be able to be in a privileged position, not just people who are born of noble blood or something. And maybe we shouldn't destroy every alien we find, you know? And you have the other side that's the more nationalistic almost, who's like, no, your bloodline matters. And also the Empire is for humans and humans only. We're not going to pollute it with any of these aliens.
I did think it was very interesting. Speaking of just the human and alien interactions, usually when you read sci-fi, humans are usually not the driving force in the universe. Right. They're usually portrayed as like the weaker, struggling to keep up kind of species. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting to see basically humans being one of the more powerful species in the galaxy.
Yeah. So in terms of themes, you know, there's definitely a strong repudiation of colonial imperialism and that kind of stuff, right? There's a whole, mm-hmm. in chapter 10 of the book, there was a discussion about how, you know, after the annexation, after we kill a lot of people, then everyone who's left, they're happy citizens. Like, yeah, the ones who are left are happy, but the others are, you know, maybe in the holds of a ship waiting to become ancillaries, or they're dead. So only the people left behind are happy.
Right. And even still, like when you looked at what happened in Ors in the big massacre, obviously, maybe they appeared happy on the surface, but right. down deep, they probably weren't that happy.
Yeah. Reading that chapter that was about the whole, essentially like the riot from the, I can't remember if it was the upper city to the lower city or which direction that was. But, you know, in the situations that we've had in the US recently with protests and riots and that kind of stuff, I was like, ooh, this is hitting too close to home right now.
Yeah, it was actually very relevant. The social issues that this book touched on was, I thought, very, very relevant to a lot of today's society. And honestly, it's stuff that we're going to have to think about. Even I know people talk about like Space Force and trying to get into space yeah. and expand the human reach. And these are all things, and especially not even just this book, but any kind of space opera or sci-fi in general, like some of these things are actually coming to fruition pretty soon. So mm-hmm. how these books address social issues, I feel like it'll hit close to home, if not now, then definitely in the near future. Mm-hmm.
As I was reading this one and the whole only having the female pronouns thing, like you mentioned earlier, like I never pictured anyone as male other than Syverdin. Everyone else I always just pictured as a woman. And I think that's a really skillful thing that Anleki did, because there can be kind of a, well, default everybody's white males, right? And this kind of throws that away and says, hey, I'm not going to describe the characters all that much, and you're going to have to just use your imagination, and I'm going to give them all female pronouns. And so we'll see what kind of game that plays in your brain.
It'll actually be really interesting to see if this ever gets adapted to television or yeah. movie. It'll be really interesting to see how they end up characterizing a lot of these characters, like how they cast them. Mm-hmm. Because I think coming out of this book, I feel like everyone will kind of have a different image in their head of how these characters look, how they actually are, if they're male or female. Right. And it's just a really, I think it was extremely skillful, and it definitely was very unique, and I enjoyed it a lot, because usually most authors, they kind of just lay out a description of the character and then that's what you have to work with. But mm-hmm. especially as you got to know the characters more, you could kind of form an image of them in your head that wasn't super conventional if you didn't want it to be.
Yeah. I'm going to be interested to hear what the Hugo Girl podcast thinks of this one, because they're covering it in July as well. So it's always fun to listen to them, because they're like the female mm-hmm. counterpart to my podcast, only there's three of them too. And so you often get different opinions. So if people don't know, I highly recommend that podcast as well.
I think it's always great too, because I have listened to them in the past, and there's so many different sci-fi just opinions out there. Yeah. I feel like books like this, no one will ever see the same book, or no one will ever see the book the same way as someone else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's so many different things that you can take out of this book, especially because things were intentionally left ambiguous.
Yes.
So it's kind of neat because you can really make this book, and I'm assuming the entire series of books, your own, and take from it what you want and make it what you want.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's funny because as I've gotten older, and I think I'm substantially older than you guys, you kind of have the stereotype of the crotchety old guy who's angry at everything and hates everything. And I've moved the other direction where, like, I feel like in my middle age, I'm giving things more of a chance and, like, going into them looking for things to enjoy, looking for things to like about them. And so I'm sure there's some of these books that, you know, some people absolutely hate, and they're like, I don't know how you enjoyed that one or spoke positively about it. But, you know, I'm always on the lookout for what kind of enjoyable things can be taken out of a read. And there's always something enjoyable about having a conversation about a book. So.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I feel like people don't have enough conversations about books these days. And honestly, I've tried to look for like online book clubs and stuff, and this is the most riveting conversation about a book that I've had in a very long time. So I appreciate you having me on the show for this, because this has been really great.
I agree. Anything else you want to talk about the book, or should we move into final thoughts?
I don't have anything unless you do.
Nope. I've come to the end of mine.
All right.
Final thoughts. So I really enjoyed this one. I definitely recommend it. I will probably pick up the rest of it on audio. I think my library actually has the audiobooks that I can get digitally. And so, so yeah, I'll check that out. And are all three out? Ancillary Justice, Ancillary Sword, and
yeah,
Ancillary Mercy, I think.
Yep. I think the final book came out in 2015, so they should all be out by now. And okay. I think there's actually, I was looking at the series on Goodreads, and I think she also wrote some short stories and one other short novel that wasn't necessarily in the same plot line, but in the same universe.
Okay. Well, it's a huge universe she made, and so I'm looking forward to checking out more of them. But audio is probably the way I'll do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoyed this book, and I'd held off reading the next two until we recorded this, so I wouldn't get mixed up, because I felt like I didn't want to like blur the lines between the novels.
Good call.
So I'm actually definitely going to be picking those up this weekend, and I definitely recommend this, because it was 100% one of the most interesting reads I think I've had in the last couple of years, and a lot to wrap your head around.
Nice. Well, so are you going to give a book report on your podcast?
I definitely will. I think so. The next episode, I'll probably do a little bit of recap and plug this episode.
Okay.
Get people in here to listen.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, I'm looking more for the rest of the series, just so, you know, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on those as well.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'll definitely kind of be recapping those as I go.
Nice. I've been thinking about some kind of extras for my patrons, and sometimes I think, you know, what I'd like to do is look back over further recommendations for reading that I've gotten, like when we talk about what comps are, you know, and cover some of those. But other things that I'd kind of like to do is, oh, hey, I read further in this series and want to talk about, you know, other books in the series. So I might do that as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, because, I mean, you look at the list of Hugos and there's a decent amount of them that are at least one of the books in a series. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yep. Okay. Well, before we sign off, how can people get a hold of you?
So you can find me personally on Twitter. My handle is @OWNerdBomber. And you can also listen to me weekly on the Online Warriors podcast. We're on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, YouTube, or you can find us at OnlineWarriorsPodcast.com.
Perfect. Nice. I like your handle. Nerd Bomber is a good handle.
Thanks. I don't know if you're familiar with the show Full House. I feel like that was kind of unavoidable in the 90s. But there was an episode where the one sister was making fun of the other and called her a nerd bomber.
Oh,
and
excellent.
For whatever reason, that just stuck with me. And I was like, you know what? I embrace that. That's I am awesome. A nerd and I am proud.
Yep. I am. I never actually watched Full House, even though I was, you know, an appropriate age to watch it at the time. My gamer handle was always Sloth, because my name is Seth, and at some point I was walking someplace in high school, and somebody who knew me walked up behind me, and he's like, "Oh, get out of my way, Sloth," because I was walking really slowly. So,
hey, sloths are my favorite animals, so that's a great handle.
Nice,
in my opinion.
Yes, so that's you know, that's what my name is on Clash of Clans. You know, that's kind of the extent of my gaming right now. All right. Well, I think that'll about wrap it up for us. Nerd Bomber, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was great having you. So really, I've been looking forward to this conversation, and I'm glad we had it.
Absolutely. Great book. Great times.
Yeah. All right. I'll talk to you later. Bye.
All right.
Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Nerd Bomber, and I highly recommend, if you're at all interested in gaming, to check out the Online Warriors podcast. They also cover pop culture topics and stuff of interest to general nerdery as well. So I think you'd be well rewarded by checking their podcast out. Of course, as always, I want to remind you, if you want to get a hold of me, you can feedback@hugospodcast.com, or you can fill out the contact form there. You can tweet at me @hugospodcast. And if you'd like to support the work that I'm doing here and on Take Me to Your Reader and Brief and Not So Brief, you can sign up to support at patreon.com/hugospodcast. And that about wraps it up. So thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.